Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. This episode is brought to you by Howard Stern. Boobs, hand jobs, curly hair, circular sunglasses. People still listen to me, right? And now, here are Alex and James.
Welcome to MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex. With me is James.
Hi, Alex.
Hi, James.
Are both hi Alexes on the track?
No, I cut the first one.
Guys, I said hi, Alex, before.
Yeah.
Hey, Alex, what's up?
Nothing. I'm here to podcast.
Let's do it.
Let's.
By the way, I think if people should know that if they donate us money, the first thing we're going to do is buy our microphone. So
yes,
we don't have to be almost kissing while we podcast. Yes. At all times. Yeah.
We're uncomfortably close when we do these podcasts.
Physically only, though. So anyway, what's up? You know what a Hollywood blacklist is, right?
Yes.
It's kind of weird, because, like, which one am I talking about, though, right?
I don't know. What do you mean?
Well, when I say Hollywood blacklist, what do you think?
Oh, I think, you know, people that have been blacklisted from Hollywood who will never be able to get a project off the ground, that type of thing.
Oh, well, I was thinking either the...
Are we talking like the 50s specifically?
Yes, I was thinking McCarthyism, I think, is the most famous example of Hollywood blacklisting, which was when there was a big communist scare, people who were communist or thought to be communist weren't allowed to work in Hollywood and were placed on a blacklist. But there's also another blacklist in Hollywood. Would you like to hear about it?
I would.
It's called The Blacklist.
Oh, wow.
And every year since 2005, a lot of producers and script readers and stuff choose what they think are the best unproduced scripts floating around Hollywood. Yeah, so they put a list together of all the best scripts that have gone unproduced. Some of them have been floating around for a long time. And basically, it's kind of just to get these scripts a bit more attention. It's movies people think should be made, and this list kind of, you know, puts a spotlight on them. If you want, they release it every year. If you want to see it, it's blacklist.com, but without the vowels, so it's like B-L-C-K. But yeah, as I said, it's scripts that people really like, so this blacklist kind of gets it a bit more attention, and a lot of these movies, after being on a blacklist for a little bit, go on to get made. The Social Network, which you're a fan of.
I did like that. I don't know. If you've heard one episode of this podcast, I feel like you've known that.
Yeah. I spent some time on the blacklist, but not too long. Chronicle, which...
which I love.
Which you love as well. Yeah. As far as movies this year, Snow White and the Huntsman.
Okay.
Which we're yet
which to looks see. Like doo-doo.
Which looks like you're going to love. I wouldn't have thought you liked Chronicle, but I'm less likely that you will like Snow White and the Huntsman.
Yeah. Chronicle is sweet.
And Safe House.
Oh, okay.
No one is safe. No one is house.
Safe house.
But I had a look at the most recent one. Have you seen that one?
I glanced through it.
Did you see the one called Chewy?
No. Oh, is it about like a Chewbacca or something?
Yeah, it's a behind-the-scenes look at the production of Star Wars from Peter Mayhew, the actor who played Chewbacca.
Yeah.
But it's not mockumentary or even documentary. It's just going to be a drama.
Yeah.
So they're going to try to make it pretty heavy, but I don't know. I guess they say that we all know how litigious George Lucas is, so.
Yeah, it's not getting made.
It's either not getting made or George Lucas is going to be the nicest person in the world in the middle, but oh well. But yeah, that's the thing. Today we're just talking about the sometimes difficult journey of a film being made, starting with, you know, first off, it's just got to get purchased. It's got to get noticed, and that's what The Blacklist is about. Hollywood starts about 10 times as many movies as it actually releases.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of these movies do get picked up. You think they're going to get made, and, you know, for any number of reasons that we're about to go over, it runs into complications and either never gets made or gets made and seriously changed or made and then changed after the fact and delayed and re-edited.
Yeah.
And it's just a nightmare sometimes. Yeah. So, yeah, we want to focus on that. Kind of after it gets picked up, you know, if you get off the blacklist or if you never make it on the blacklist, but your script gets purchased anyway, the next bad place you might find yourself is development hell.
Yes.
So what's that all about?
Development hell is sort of like, well, your script's been purchased, but you just kind of can't get the movie off the ground. Like, you can't get the financing for it, right?
Yeah, it's a series of things. Like, you know, development hell is kind of a broad term, but it's basically anything where the script has been purchased, but now we have a problem about actually making it.
Yeah.
So maybe it's the tone of the movie is wrong, or some of the funding isn't coming together, or whatever. That's called development hell, where it's, you know, it's totally off. It's totally been purchased. It's, they want to make this movie, but they're just running into a series of problems.
Yes. Yeah.
And so often what's happened is, you know, a studio sees a script they really like. They purchase it and they say, this is kind of a true example. They say, David Fincher would be really good for this role.
Yes.
Which you'd probably agree with, no matter what the script
is. Yeah, doesn't matter.
And so David Fincher comes to this production and now he says, look, the script's okay, but I really would rather it be like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as we discussed in adaptations or something, he's been attached to a number of superhero movies and things where it just kind of comes to kind of, they kind of run into trouble when the studio and the director have to decide on the tone of the movie or even something's bigger than the tone. Maybe the whole ending or something needs to be changed in the director's opinion.
Yeah. And, you know, like that's where you'll get creative differences, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
so when, why did he walk off the set? Creative differences.
Yeah, exactly.
Which could be, you know, I wanted it to end this way. I wanted it to end this way. Or
just even more general than that.
Or we just didn't even get along. There was no way we were going to survive making a movie together.
Well, and one we talked about fairly recently was Mission Impossible 3, which David Fincher was attached to and Joe Carnahan was attached to and like went through pre-production and then left due to creative differences, which clearly must have been like a tonal thing because,
yeah.
I mean, if you watch any of Joe Carnahan's movies, they're pretty different from what Mission Impossible 3 ended up being. So,
right.
Yeah, makes sense, generally.
Yeah, and as we said, yes, I mean, the director's so important to a movie that if he comes on and doesn't like it, then... You know,
yeah.
Sometimes they just have to start from scratch altogether.
Mm-hmm.
I guess Superman would be a really famous one. I know we've touched on that before, but
is this the Richard Donner one or the 90s one?
Well, I was thinking throughout the entire franchise,
yeah.
So many Superman scripts have been started,
okay.
And projects have been started,
mm-hmm.
And you know, J.J. Abrams had Flyby, and mm-hmm. there's always the Batman versus Superman,
Wolfgang Peterson.
Yeah, there's tons of them. And then Kevin Smith has an interesting
Superman Lives
Superman story.
Yeah.
Oh, but his with the producer who would go on to do
Giant Spider. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah.
He the producer gave one note, and it was there needs to be a giant spider.
No,
or whatever,
no, no. He had three notes.
Three notes. Okay.
Three notes. So Kevin Smith, who is a big comic book fan, big Superman fan, wrote a Superman script. It got purchased, and the studio kind of had him do all these kind of talks and interviews with people who would be either involved in making the movie or just executives who would be, you know, marketing and things like that. And there's a producer whose name I forget right now.
D. Bonaventura or something.
Is that it?
I don't know. I'm just pulling producer names out of
hats. Oh, okay. No, I thought it was Joe something. I don't know. I can look it up. Anyway, he had three notes for Kevin Smith's Superman script. Three things that he needed to change. One is Superman can't wear the Superman outfit.
Okay.
So no Superman suit, which is kind of integral to Superman, but whatever. Okay. The second note was that he cannot fly.
Okay.
Again, kind of a departure from the Superman we've all come to know and love.
But not as quick of a departure as Superman is typically used to make.
Zing. And the third note was that in the third act, Superman has to fight a giant mechanical spider.
Yes. Man versus spider.
Yes.
So man versus mega spider.
This languished in development hell for long enough, and eventually it kind of just got put out of its misery.
Yep.
That producer would go on to make Wild Wild West,
yep.
In which, if you'll pay close attention to the third act, there's a gigantic mechanical spider who is evil.
Yeah.
So that would be kind of a good description of development hell.
Yes.
I mean, they want it to go, but it's not developed. Nick Cage had a little bit of Superman.
Yep. Like, there's pictures of him in the suit.
Yeah, they made it far enough, but it, again, hit a roadblock. Any other famous examples you know of development hell?
Famous examples. There have to be some.
Yeah, there's tons.
There's tons.
Didn't Orson Welles have a hard time with Don Quixote?
Oh, you mean Terry Gilliam's
Don Quixote? Terry Gilliam.
Yeah,
right,
yeah.
Right.
And, like, such a big... That movie's so interesting that it's got a documentary on the failure to make that movie.
Yeah, I mean, you know you're stalled for long enough that someone goes, let's get our film equipment out there and film them trying to make this movie because we know they're not going anywhere anytime soon.
And it's this really depressing documentary.
Yeah, see, I've never seen it. I've heard it's good, though.
It's called Lost in La Mancha.
Yeah, what's it like?
It's basically documenting Terry Gilliam's efforts to get his Don Quixote movie off the ground. It was going to have Johnny Depp playing who's the guy that's not Don Quixote that would be in that story? Pancho something?
Yeah.
Pancho Villa?
No, it's a Mexican revolutionary. It is something close to that, okay. Though. You're right. That came into my head, too.
But, yeah, and it was just, they ended up finally getting some funding that they started shooting, and then it was just, like, just the shoot was totally, the weather was terrible in their locations, and they just, the guy that they had playing Don Quixote had, like, real hip problems and couldn't ride a horse, so they basically had to shut down, and then money ran out, and it was really depressing.
Yeah.
But, yeah. And anybody that's interested in this type of stuff should watch Lost La Mancha, because it's very interesting.
Orson Welles did have, that's why I think his name is in my head, he did have a couple projects that were infamously, like, dragged out and took a long time to shoot. He was big, kind of once he, you know, made a name for himself, he really wanted complete control of everything.
Yep.
He had some problems with creative control, so he wanted to finance all his own movies and, you know, find his own financial backers and stuff. And he would often go over schedule and over budget, and then the money would run out, and then he'd have to find someone else to back it again. And so it was always going in and out of production. The Magnificent Ambersons was one that a lot of people know. Some people still consider it one of the best American movies ever made, although he's not, or wasn't very happy with it in the end.
Yeah. Wes Anderson loves that movie.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I guess it sounds like the Royal Tenenbaums. So. Yeah. Yeah. And that was the plot. It was a rich, wealthy family, I think, who was going back and forth and had their own kind of interpersonal struggles. But he shot most of it. He lost editing control to RKO. And then they basically changed the second half of the movie and tacked on a super happy ending that Orson's not very big on, if you know anything about Orson Welles. But yeah, it was still well-received. A couple decades later, kind of the same thing with the movie called The Other Side of the Wind. Again, Orson Welles wanting to fund it himself.
Yeah.
Money running out, going back and forth. But yeah, they shooting it for 7 years because they'd shoot a bit, run out of money, edit it, run out of money, shoot some more, find another backer. He got some funding from the brother-in-law of the Shah of Iran.
Okay.
And
which sounds like a textbook Orson Welles story.
Like this won't run into trouble. And then some political turmoil. They ended up being locked in a vault, and he had no access to it and was told he had no rights to it or anything.
Yep.
It was just a complete nightmare, a total mess. But the 7 years of shooting is not the world record. The Thief and the Cobbler.
Okay.
Ever heard of that?
I've heard of the title.
Yeah. It's got the world record for 31 years of production.
Okay.
So
challenge accepted. Let's start a movie.
Yeah. And when we're in our 50s, finish it.
Yeah.
But yeah,
it's going to be a short film.
This was an animated fantasy film shot from, or animated put together from 1964 to 1995. Decent stretch.
Oh, that's why I've heard of it, because if it came out when I was a child, you know.
Yeah. Well, it failed to make a big splash.
Yeah.
Richard Williams was the Canadian animator who was behind it. And, I mean, this was starting in the 60s. You're still working with a lot of hand-drawn animation, a lot of very old techniques, and just kind of on the tail end of the golden era of animation. Again, kind of the same thing. Run out of money, get it back going again. You'll find funding is a big issue in development hell. But he was the one who was really responsible for Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Okay.
And so when that became successful, he chose to finish it off.
Okay.
Distributors pulled out and because he didn't get it done on time. And so it was kind of finished without a lot of his creative input.
Okay. Fair enough.
So $28 million later and 31 years later, it made $900,000 in theaters.
Oh, how about that?
So totally worth his time.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, it's still kind of, it's got a cult status partly because of the story and partly because there are, I mean, really good pieces of animation.
Mm-hmm.
Work on it for 30 years, hopefully.
Yeah, exactly.
Hopefully part of it looks good. Yeah.
Hopefully you did something correct.
in the meantime. Mm. Yeah. And so, yeah, that's kind of just getting it made, putting it all together. Sometimes it's all shot and you kind of get into what we call post-production.
Yes.
I mean, in the film biz, I'm sure you know, there's pre-production.
Yes. Where you sort of like, you know, you've got your script, you're planning it out, how you're going to shoot it, a lot of storyboarding, that type of thing.
Yeah, some casting and stuff.
Yeah.
And then production, which is pretty much just the shoot.
Yeah.
Right?
More or less, yeah.
And then what would be post-production? And I think this is the part where, and I fully admit, this was my thought too, probably the most ignored part of filmmaking, I think, for people who don't know a lot about movies.
Yeah, that seems about right. Post-production is where, and I mean, very often there's overlap in these things.
Right.
Like, particularly with big effects movies, like once you've shot a scene, you're sending, like say Transformers 3, once you've shot a key effect scene, if you shoot that first, you're sending the footage immediately to the CGI guys to add Optimus to the mix. post-production generally is visual effects, like, you know, not visual effects that weren't done in camera, which now is basically everything. And editing, and that's when you find out if you need some reshoots. You know, you're cutting trailers as well. Post-production can most easily be summed up by saying editing.
Yeah.
And a lot of times you can't really tell until you see the whole movie sort of assembled that something just totally doesn't work.
Right.
And so that's how you'll get to reshoots sometimes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that's a big part of post-production hell.
Yeah.
You want to avoid reshoots. I mean, if you've done everything right. I mean, sometimes it's inevitable, but
It's not always a bad thing.
Like, to have to do a reshoot?
Yeah. Like, one of my favorite movies of the last year was The Adjustment Bureau, and they had to reshoot the ending. And I mean, as it is, the ending is the weakest part of the movie, but that movie was delayed like a year, and that's never a good sign, but The Adjustment Bureau ended up being pretty great.
Right.
And so, I mean, sometimes these things can work out, but very often it's the other way.
Yeah, and what are usually the causes for a reshoot? Is it something going wrong, or
the studio doesn't think they can market something about it, or that the tone doesn't work for them? Those pretty general concerns.
Yeah, and sometimes, and this ties in with some of the answers you gave, which I'd say were correct, but if just a focus group doesn't like it.
Yeah, that's true.
If it just doesn't test very well, they say we need less of this character, or this character they like more of that, make it happier or more serious.
Yeah, and very often, like, test audiences will see sort of a flabby version of the movie, and they'll use, you know, those cards to tell them what to cut, what to use more of. And very often, like, if you listen to director's commentaries, very often you'll hear directors talking about, oh, this scene, we just had it in the focus group just to see how it would play. We didn't really think we'd leave it in. And the audience just loved it. So we left it in, and the audience turned out to be right, or whatever. Generally what the directors say, because they just wouldn't point it out if they thought the audience was wrong.
Doesn't Michael Bay have a good one about people leaving the theater during focus groups and him knowing?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's going to go.
Michael Bay, the way he watches focus groups is if there's ever a point where he sees too many people getting up to go to the washroom, that's when he realizes he needs an action beat. And that's where the San Francisco car chase in The Rock is. Too many people were getting up and going to the washroom in between the 40 minutes where there's no action there.
My films transcend bodily function.
Yeah, exactly.
There'll be none of this.
I'm going to make it so that they have to piss their pants to make it through the whole movie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as you said, I mean, reshoots, they do it a lot, and it's not always bad, but it's rarely a good sign.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just that they've got something wrong, but that's more money you have to sink into the project.
Yeah, exactly.
And if it's way after the fact, and, you know, maybe you need to build sets that have been destroyed, or, you know, go somewhere that something's changed, so you have to set it back to, you know, say it was shot in a period or something, you know, do all those things.
Yeah.
So it can be pretty costly, especially after the fact.
Yeah, and a good example of one where a studio just got totally worried about a movie and sort of forced reshoots was Wolverine. There were a lot of reshoots on Wolverine, a movie that ended up sucking.
The X-Men Origins one, right?
Yeah, X-Men Origins. Movie that was terrible. And I don't know what elements of it could have been considered good. Like, I don't know that you can totally blame it on the studio, because all of it was pretty terrible.
Yeah.
It's not like there was a couple great scenes and then some stuff that was clearly studio enforced, but that was a movie where there was a lot of money pumped into it, and apparently the director, Gavin Hood, sort of like lost control of the movie, and Fox sort of took over, or Fox demanded these reshoots, and it didn't work out for that movie, both financially and critically.
Critically, yeah.
Like, I mean, I would imagine it eventually made its money back, but I don't think it was a big hit.
Right. And with a franchise as popular as X-Men, using its most valuable character, you would hope for better.
Yeah, and another part about that movie is that Hugh Jackman really took to the internet version of the streets to deny that there were problems with the production. Like, he did sort of like a question and answer thing on Ain't It Cool about how don't worry, we're just doing reshoots to add to the overall feel of the movie. The trailer gets across the really tone of the movie, and it's going to be great. It's badass. I love it, you know, all this stuff.
Yeah.
And which might be the only time Hugh Jackman has ever lied to us.
As far as we know.
Yeah. When he declared the musical was back, it was back.
Unless he ever said, I'm not awesome. Yeah. I don't know of any other lies.
Exactly.
Well, you said something earlier about the money being a part of it, and I came across someone talking about this horrible, vicious cycle of, so they put some more money into it, or so they finish their movie, they show the edit to a focus group, and the focus group says, you know, I didn't like the ending, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
So now they sink more money into it to shoot the ending, and this kind of means that, you know, since they spent more money on it, they need to recoup these losses, so it has to be really good, so they test it again, and then it just gets into this horrible cycle of testing, and now it's more expensive, so it needs to be better to recoup this additional money, yep. And it just turns into a total disaster.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
I know Sergio Leone fan right here.
Yes. Yeah, we both are, I think.
And have you seen Once Upon a Time in America?
No, I haven't.
Do you know about this editing story?
Yeah, it's like the Leone version that he wanted or something was like 4 hours, and the one that was released in like 82 or whatever that movie came out was like 2.5.
Yeah, and there's even a couple in there where it kind of got shaved down like 40 minutes at a time until it was half the length of, I mean, it was supposed to be this big gangster epic, and I mean, 2 hours is still long, but when you've cut out literally half your movie, and I haven't seen it, and I couldn't read too much about it because I do want to see it and not have it spoiled, but I guess part of the movie is told through flashbacks in a particular order.
Okay.
And they just cut all that together. Okay. So it wasn't just an edit. I mean, they rearranged and completely shifted the narrative structure of this movie. And Sergio Leone obviously wasn't a big fan. Directors rarely are. And it was the last movie he ever made.
Yeah.
And I mean, he did die 3 years later, so maybe that was part of it. But I think it makes people bitter. I mean,
there is a 4 hour cut on DVD, you know, like his vision has been realized.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, yeah, I mean, it just sounds like him and Orson Welles. I just think these are the kinds of things when you hear about directors who hate the studios or don't get along with them. These are the exact kinds of battles that usually comes from.
Yeah. Yeah. That type of thing. And the thing with Orson Welles is that given his era, it wasn't the technology to eventually make his version of the Magnificent Ambersons happen.
Yeah.
Because, you know, by any sort of footage that he had that could have been used is long gone. Whereas Sergio Leone, that was only in the 80s, and you can still find that footage and restore it and put it in. It's the same sort of thing as Francis Ford Coppola and Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
When he did, the much publicized Apocalypse Now Redux in early 2000s, because he still had access to that footage.
Yeah.
So, and these are directors with clout, and people would want to see a full Sergio Leone version of Once Upon a Time in America because he's got respect, and it's the same with Francis Ford Coppola and Apocalypse Now.
You know? Yeah, and as you said, I mean, it's just a difference in time, too. I mean, there are number one movies from the 30s that are just lost.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Because it was so much harder to keep track of it, and I mean, materials and stuff were so much more expensive that you can't just be keeping around film because maybe one day someone wants a fan edit.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't think they knew what fan edits were in the 30s.
A Scanner Darkly had a long time of
production.
Yeah. And just not knowing quite what way to go with it.
Like, was Linklater already attached? Or,
yeah.
Like,
well, after it was shot, I think just how exactly to do the rotoscoping. I mean, it was a very unique movie visually. Yeah. So I don't know if they just didn't have confidence that that was going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And well, it is also just a weird movie.
Yeah.
So, and I think, I mean, when we see a lot of reshoots and stuff, it seems like it's movies that are trying something a little bit more experimental.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see why the studios might be, you know, a bit more nervous for that working.
Yeah, the thing that's kind of surprising to me about Scanner Darkly is that you would think, like, that is after Waking Life. So you think they know where he's going with it if he's talking about doing this rotoscoping again.
Yeah.
And it's not like the visual style of Scanner Darkly was totally the same as Waking Life, because Waking Life was changing throughout, whereas Scanner Darkly had a more consistent style.
Yeah.
But yeah, I feel like it would have been easier to explain. Like, remember that movie I made, Waking Life? It's going to be like that, except less crazy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's still going to be a little crazy.
Well, it's still a sci-fi.
It's less crazy than...
It's a sci-fi movie about addiction, right? Is that what it's about? I haven't seen it since it was in theaters.
But, oh, yeah, yeah. That's it.
And
but it's also... they kind of, like, dress up and look... Like, it's kind of... They can be avatars in a way. So there is that.
I remember that. Yeah. And yeah, that was, you know, why that the rotoscoping worked so well with that, because those suit blanket things that they used look super cool.
Yeah. Do you know about Exorcist 3, Legion?
There's so much. Is this the Paul Schrader one that turned into Exorcist the Beginning, or?
No, Paul Schrader's in one?
Paul Schrader, the writer.
Oh, I thought you meant, what's
he,
the guy?
He wrote Taxi Driver.
Right. I was thinking of the guy that used to be on Parks and Rec and is in Assassination of Jesse James.
Oh, Paul Schneider.
Paul Schneider. Yeah. I think I made that mistake on the Taxi Driver.
Probably.
No, this is a different one than that.
Okay.
This was a screenplay based on a novel. The novel is just called Legion. It wasn't supposed to be part of the Exorcist series.
Okay.
Then the movie got shot. It was supposed to be William Friedkin directing, who was the director of The Exorcist.
Yeah.
But this wasn't supposed to be part of The Exorcist series, part of the film franchise. And, just a total nightmare. Again, what was his name? This is like one of the only things he did. William Paul Blatty or something?
Okay.
Yeah.
The name kind of rings a bell.
No, the last name's definitely Blatty. I know that for sure.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he was the one who wrote the script, and after they couldn't get Friedkin to do it, he said, okay, I'll direct it.
Yeah.
And so he directed.
Fine, you've twisted my arm. Don't make me direct.
So he directed it as this movie called Legion, and he was really happy about it. He thought it was pretty original and very good. And even though Exorcist 2 was a total bomb and lost a lot of money and was not critically respected, they decided to make this part of the Exorcism series.
Yeah.
And they said, you know, we'll try to parlay some success from Exorcist 1 to Exorcist 3. Mm-hmm. But the problem with Legion is that there were no exorcisms in it.
Okay.
So it was tough to really tack it onto that franchise.
Yeah.
So a $4 million reshoot was required to have a scene with an exorcism in it. Mm-hmm. He wasn't a big fan of this. I would kind of want to see this movie because I want to see how bad it is.
Yeah.
And Brad Dourif's the bad guy, and I like Brad Dourif.
Best known as Chucky.
Yes. Yeah. And you can see right here the list of cameo appearances that were supposed to be in this movie.
Patrick Ewing.
Patrick Ewing, John Thompson, Fabio, Ex-Surgeon General C. Everett Koop, Larry King, and Samuel L. Jackson all ended up being in this movie for real.
So that's great.
Yeah. It's a great cast.
What other movies has Patrick Ewing been in other than Space Jam? Is it like Space Jam and Exorcist 3? That's awesome.
No idea. Mm. But yeah, even this was the 80s, I believe, and they totally rearranged some scenes, completely cut some that Blatty wanted to keep in there. And when I say they, I mean the studio. And those are now lost and cannot be restored, tragically.
Yeah. Much to the chagrin of America.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it was just kind of edited, really mangled against his wishes. He still talks about how much better the original script was and just completely made him bitter.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell the story about Fanboys?
Yeah, well, Fanboys was sort of... this podcast was suggested to us by Matt Wiles, and... one of the more famous examples recently of people our age that, you know, that we're aware of was this movie Fanboys, which is about this group of friends, you know, kind of nerdy types who are really into Star Wars.
Fanboys, if you will.
Yeah, that's a good point. I never made the connection. They're trying to travel to Skywalker Ranch to see an early cut of The Phantom Menace before it's released. And the movie takes place, you know, 98 or 99. And but there was one character who has cancer. And that's basically the driving force of this movie. They're going because, one, their friendships have sort of fallen by the wayside over time, and two, their friend has cancer, and they just want to make sure he sees this movie.
Yeah, and just kind of one last thing before he dies.
Yeah, like, to make sure he sees it before he dies. But the wine, it was owned by the Weinsteins, who wanted to cut out the cancer thing to make it more sellable.
Yeah, and was that just to make it more lighthearted and so they could do it as
a comedy? I think so, yeah.
Okay.
And it is a comedy. It's definably a comedy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was released probably two, maybe 3 years after it was already shot and, you know, ready to go. And there's a variety of cameos in this movie of people you would recognize. I mean, Kristen Bell has a role. That Dan Fogler guy, who's in everything but sucks, is in it.
Kevin Smith got in there.
I don't know that he did.
Oh, no? I thought I read that he saw an early version of it and asked to be in it.
Oh, okay.
Had a small cameo or something.
That seems possible. There are a lot of cameos. Seth Rogen's in it. I feel like, yeah, William Shatner's in it. It was a pretty great cameo there. But yeah, it's a middling comedy, but the thing about it that works, and when it eventually got released, it was pretty much straight to DVD. I didn't see any sort of theatrical release for it. But when it did eventually get released, probably 2 years ago now, the cancer thing was the only part that made it unique and kind of interesting, and, you know, kind of sweet. But yeah, without that, it's just like just a bad comedy, basically, that will occasionally make you laugh, but has nothing going on
and
for
so
it.
The cancer is gone from the released version?
No, it ended up,
they didn't
left
put it
in, but they never put any marketing money behind it.
Oh, that
sort of thing. Like the, I think what it basically came down to is like, do you want this movie to remain true to what you wrote, or do you want it to be marketed? that was basically the argument, and yeah.
And yeah, I mean,
and Weinstein's kind of famous for cutting movies as well.
Yes.
The Weinsteins are famous for cutting movies.
That I know.
Generally more to make them more awards worthy than just to make them marketable.
But, okay. Yeah. And I mean, so when did it actually end up coming out?
2-3 years ago.
Okay.
Probably, yeah, 3 years ago.
And you said it was kind of done, but not released for 2-3 years?
Yeah, yeah. And it was shot, it was shot a couple years before then. And then just sort of stuck in post-production hell type of thing.
Yeah, and because wouldn't it be a lot more timely if it came out right around the same time as Phantom Menace? Like,
well, no,
obviously it couldn't have happened right then, but...
Yeah, the one of the funny things about the movie is that it had some sort of distance from the Phantom Menace. So you could make, like, all these little jokes about the Phantom Menace sucking throughout the movie. Like, one of the... right before the group finally sees a screening of the movie, because the ending of the movie is they get to Skywalker Ranch and George Lucas or whoever is in charge will let just the friend with cancer see the movie. He doesn't want...
Okay.
You know, and so when the other four or five friends eventually see the movie, like, by the end of the movie, their friend has died. And when they eventually see a screening of the movie, like, I'm pretty sure the last part of the movie is... Hey guys, what if it sucks? And I mean, that's great. That's a great joke.
Yeah.
And I think that distance really allowed some sort of better commenting on.
Okay.
And I mean, like, because you didn't know how crazy the fanboy aspect of that movie was going to be until after it came out. Like, maybe time it for the Revenge of the Sith. I see that point, but Revenge of the Sith was like 2006, I think, at the latest. So couldn't really pull that off.
Okay. Yeah, no, I was just reading about people talking about the different edits, and they're saying, without the cancer thing, it's like, let's get drunk and break into Skywalker Ranch. Like, I haven't seen it, but it really sounds like without that, you're missing the crux of the movie,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's the quote-unquote heart of the film, and like I said, it's the only part of the movie that's even halfway different from, like, a B Apatow movie.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of road... comedy, yeah.
Halfway between Apatow and Kevin Smith, I guess.
Well, just reading about that in other movies, especially when they talk about cutting subplots,
mm-hmm.
and that's kind of one thing. Let's say people think this movie's about 20 minutes too long.
Mm-hmm.
Let's cut this entire subplot, and then it's, you know, nice and neat and mm-hmm. shorter. I'm just amazed by how, I guess, compartmentalized subplots are, like,
yeah.
that you can do that without mm-hmm. having to reshoot a lot of scenes.
Yeah.
Like, I know you probably talked about it in the Annie Hall one, but there's supposed to be a murder mystery
yep.
subplot.
Yeah, I don't think they shot that, though. I think they cut that out of the script. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, yeah, I guess if it's early on enough, you can just cut it from the script and rework some things. But This is what
I mean, we talked about it in American Beauty, the court trial that gets cut out in pre-production as well. But.
Yeah. Oh, and I just mean, I think that's where they run into these problems with changing things so late is that's when the money's going to come in. You have to reshoot all these scenes. Have you heard Patton Oswalt talking about being in the punch-up tables?
Yes. Yeah. And I love Pat. Like, I like Patton Oswalt as a comedian. As a guy as a commenting on media, he's amazing.
Yeah.
Like, he needs a weekly column somewhere or just writing about media because he's incredible.
Yeah.
And he has such great information and, you know, like, insider knowledge, and just the way he comments on it is spectacular.
Yeah. What was the punch-up table story?
It's just sort of like they wasn't he brought in to write jokes that could happen from off screen so they didn't have to actually change the movie, but it was just people shouting things?
Yeah, it was thinking, I mean, what we've been talking about is reshooting things. It's like, there's something wrong with this movie, let's improve it by shooting this scene like this instead of the way we shot it originally. This one was a much cheaper solution of, let's keep the movie exactly as it is, but what can we add that doesn't involve reshooting anything?
Yeah.
And that's really just words being said. Like, just voiceovers are things like off screen being yelled at the characters. Yeah. So he was just saying, I've written scripts, I've done punch-ups like before they've shot it, but after it's shot, you're pretty much limited to someone off screen being like, when someone walks off the screen, they go, oh, he fell in some poo. Like, yeah. There's not much you can do without changing anything visual, right?
Yeah, like, exactly.
You're pretty limited. So was that Disney that he was working at that
for? I think
for?
So, yeah.
And just kind of suggested better ways to do this. Like, bring us in here before you've shot everything and we'll make them funnier with more than just poo falling.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a funny story. I like it.
Yeah. Just to go back to Fanboys for 1 second. It kind of got like a popular following from the fanboy community before
it
got released.
Because it was, right? You know, like for us, by us type thing. You know, yeah, like, we're going to support
you're
it.
Dealing with a very nerdy group of technologically inclined people. Yeah. So, yeah, that happens. Yeah, and it's just, you know, kind of just the same things of the studio not thinking they're going to be able to make money off it, mm-hmm, and things like that. And sometimes when it comes to certain artists, they're just not happy with it. And by artist, I mean like a certain director or something. Mm-hmm. Like, things just go on, and it never, as you said, sometimes you have to sit there and watch it all to know whether something works or doesn't work. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this isn't something that's exclusive to film, like Chinese Democracy,
yes.
Guns N' Roses. That was, what, 17 years?
Something like that, yeah.
And I know that wasn't 17 years of sitting at a desk and trying to write that, but he's kicking ideas around his head for a long time.
Yeah, yeah, that was very much an Axl Rose's perfectionism type of thing, you know.
Spend more time deciding on whether or not he should wear cornrows.
No, he's decided it. It's yes. Yes, no, he should.
I'm saying you should spend more time thinking about that.
Gotcha.
You said earlier that delayed release is never a good sign.
I get in this argument sometimes with Travis because it never seems like a good sign, but sometimes it works out. Like, it's not definitely a bad sign. Like, I mean, I brought up the Adjustment Bureau and I'm having trouble thinking of something else off the top of my head, but sometimes studios are right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because when you take a step back, it's, what are they doing? They're taking some time to make sure it's actually good before they release it.
Yeah.
You know, in a way that sounds very positive, but at the same time, it's like, they've shot this movie and they know it's not very good.
Yeah.
And they're not just going to make a new movie. They're just going to tweak this piece of shit slightly. So it's a slightly less stinky piece of shit and still want us to pay for it.
There's a different way. Like, if you were just like, oh God, this movie's terrible, we need to reshoot with a Justin Bieber cameo, you know, like if it's that type of thing, then that's very worrying. But yeah, sometimes, you know, like when you see Final Cut assembled and something just doesn't work and you just have to change it. And yeah, I mean, sometimes these things don't work out, like the narration in Blade Runner. You know, that's generally
That's a good example of a big change.
Yeah. There's a 3-hour documentary on the making of that movie. That's actually so watchable. Like, you can sit and just watch the whole thing. It's called Dangerous Days, I think. But yeah, and there was narration added that basically explained everything about the movie, and a similar thing happened with Dark City in the 1998, And narration takes basically all of the questions out of the movies and just sort of explains it all to you. And just,
I know,
just like studios basically dumbing it down because they were worried that the audience wouldn't understand.
Yeah. And I mean, knowing what we know now of the Blade Runner that actually got released, it's so supposed to be morally ambiguous and yeah. so many things.
Yeah. The director's cut version.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it's a noir. Those movies weren't supposed to be clean, like clear cut. That was kind of the whole point of it. Yep. Right. Do you know about the day the clown cried? The Jerry Lewis movie?
Oh, I wasn't sure if this was an actual day or a movie.
Oh, no. Remember that clown?
December 8th. The day the clown cried.
The day that we're living in for me.
Died. Wait, was that Pearl Harbor Day, too?
That was December 9th.
Okay.
But close.
No. Just wanted to make sure I wasn't shitting on all the veterans of Pearl Harbor.
You're not. Okay. They don't listen to this anyway.
Yeah, that's a good point. Plus, Michael Bay already did a good job of it.
More Michael Bay references. Yep. But this is a movie that did have some problems after it was shot. And I just wanted to highlight this one because it has a very kind of specific problem. It had some political problems. It was kind of, the story was about a circus clown who gets sent to a Nazi concentration camp.
Okay.
So we're dealing with some sensitive issues here.
Yes.
And this is one thing that...
And when is this?
Oh, 19... I'm not sure. Jerry Lewis was alive. Well, I guess a lot of it was shot in the early 70s, but it still hasn't been released, mm-hmm. kind of famously. Okay. It's one of those movies that no one's really working on it, but it's not been entirely scrapped, so it's just considered unreleased at this point. So, I mean, we're dealing with the concentration camps. It's a little sensitive.
Yeah, a little bit.
But yeah, this wasn't really kind of... an artistic disagreement. I guess it was in a way, but some people just thought he didn't deal with it in a sensitive enough manner.
Okay.
And it was a kind of a dark comedy. So, but at the same time, I genuinely believe he wasn't trying to make light of the situation or make jokes at its expense. But to some people, it kind of came off that way.
Gotcha.
And I guess Harry Shearer saw a copy and was like, no, that's not how this should be addressed. Gotcha. I mean, we have movies like, Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator, where mm-hmm. he literally plays Hitler. I mean, I guess there's a way to deal with these, but no one really thought Jerry Lewis did it in a sensitive enough manner.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is kind of one thing that people will run into. Maybe just something is just politically sensitive, and sometimes in between the script being purchased or the film being made, something has happened in the real world that... this might not be appropriate anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
We talked about it with that Spider-Man trailer with the Twin Towers.
I mean, 9/11 had a lot of examples. Collateral Damage with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, what happened with that one?
That's release date was delayed because it was shot for release, I think early 2002. It ended up being released in 2002, but it was... Or wait, no, it was supposed to come out October 2001, and it ended up coming out in 2002, and it was very...
Judging by the title, I think some innocent people died in it. Yeah.
Well, that's the idea. I think his wife and kid die as collateral damage, and he's a firefighter who goes and goes on a killing rampage of Islamic terrorists. It got delayed to 2002, and it wasn't very good. I've seen it. And there was also Spider-Man, like you said, that trailer, more or less. And the Bourne Identity, its climax was changed so that it didn't involve blowing up a building. 24
in New York, too?
Was it?
I don't know.
Okay. I wouldn't think it would be New York, but it was just...
Because
they never...
I'm thinking the last one.
They never get stateside till the third movie. Bourne doesn't. But... And 24 had, I mean, this is a smaller example. 24's pilot had a plane crash in it, and 24 premiered in like September 2001 or October 2001. So that had to go. It's just these things. 9/11 was chock full of these types of things.
Yeah, and this is just something
for
that
valid reason.
Yeah, just something that it just happens, and it's something that you couldn't predict, and just. I mean, we've been talking about financial things happening, kind of artistic choices, but this is just kind of a political one. Mm-hmm. Or, anything cultural that has changed in the meantime can see your movie get made or just not released altogether.
Yep.
Or just a project dies because now it's far too sensitive.
Yeah.
One other one was in an extremely goofy movie.
Okay.
They go to the X Games, I guess.
Okay. Sounds extremely goofy.
Yeah. And I guess there's a big paper mache X, like the logo of the X Games. Mm-hmm. And then they're in kind of the top of one of them.
Okay.
And it starts burning from below. And so it looks a lot like a World Trade Center. And they're stuck. So they just had to... That movie got released as it was because it was before 9/11. Mm-hmm. But now, just in the meantime, just since then, on TV, when they air it and stuff, they've
cut that.
Edited that scene. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's another time that we do see... A lot of edits and a lot of changes to a movie is its transition to television, right?
Yeah, exactly.
There's a couple reasons. I mean, that one we discussed is, you know, just politically or culturally sensitive at the time, and understandably so. Then sometimes it just gets shortened. We just see cuts just so a two-hour movie can play in 2 hours with commercials or something like that. Sometimes they even add things to make it longer.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of just... The normal censorship. We're used to.
Yeah.
So you can air a R-rated movie at any time as long as you cut out a lot of it.
Yeah, as long as everybody is now a rascal instead of an asshole.
Yeah. Or I think my favorite is Big Lebowski.
I don't remember, but I definitely remember. Oh, it's skiing in the Alps?
This is what happens when you find a stranger in the Alps instead of fuck a stranger in the ass. Do you have any other... examples of favorite edits that you know of?
What is that monkey? I've had it with these monkey fighting snakes on this Monday to Friday plane or something.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's the snakes on
the snakes
plane.
Snakes in a plane one.
Yeah.
Any other development hell stories? I remember the first time hearing about, not the first time hearing about, but you and I, a long time ago when Alpha Dogs was coming out.
Yeah.
I was like, this looks really bad. And you're like, yeah, it's delayed release. Like, it's been kicking around as a finished film for like 2 years.
Really?
This is not a good sign.
I'm surprised I knew that because I do not remember that.
Yeah.
It doesn't surprise me that I knew that and forgot it. But,
yeah. And it doesn't surprise me you didn't have much hope in Alpha Dogs or whatever that movie was called.
Yeah. No, it looked brutal. Yeah. And even when I would talk to people about it that liked it, I was like, I don't think so. Don't think you're right.
You are incorrect.
Yeah.
That is not how you feel about that movie.
Look, some opinions are objectively wrong.
This is one.
Put it out there.
All right. Well, anything else?
Nope. Thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man, and join us next week.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com, or follow us on Twitter @themacguffinmen.